WFAE streaming is sponsored by Corporate Information Technologies, a local IT company assisting business and taking a proactive approach to technology. CIT, let us show you how good IT can be. corp-infotech.com.
This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins.
I do agree with Obama on many of the national security issues, on foreign policy, on engagement.
Former Nebraska Senator Chuck Hagel, a Republican, talking to us just days before the 2008 presidential election. This week, President Obama nominated him to be the nation's next Secretary of Defense, praising his patriotism and heroism, adding that his appointment would be historic.
He'd be the first person of enlisted rank to serve as Secretary of Defense. One of the few secretaries who've been wounded in war, and the first Vietnam veteran to lead the department.
In our 2008 conversation, Senator Hagel spoke about his career and reputation as an outspoken political leader who challenged the policies of the Bush administration, and he shared his thoughts on foreign policy and the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan. In light of his nomination to be the next Secretary of Defense, we hear part of that conversation, and then we'll talk to political scientist Dr. Michael Bitzer about the battle Senator Hagel will face in the days to come on Capitol Hill.
Michael, thank you. I am delighted and honored to be on your show. It's always a privilege to engage with the people who shape and mold opinions and have a significant amount of influence in our country. And I've always thought that the more we can engage, the more we can educate and inform, and that's the essence of a strong democracy.
Is that because you used to do this?
I had no talent, Mike, and I had to leave your world and get into government work. And I find myself in the United States Senate where no skills are required.
Oh, really? It has said by some that you have become Barack Obama's Joe Lieberman. You think that's true?
Well, that's a bit of a stretch. I don't know when I was last seen on a platform introducing Obama at a campaign rally.
Never, I don't think.
I don't think so. This is a business that brings out all kinds of interesting speculation and punditry and wizardry and most of it's nonsense. But I know Barack Obama well. I know John McCain well, and they are both good friends. So I'm delighted to announce this morning that the next president will be a very good friend of mine. And I have told them each that I'll help them in any way I can, and I respect both. They are very smart, bright, decent, capable men who care about their country.
I want to come back to your punditry wizardry comment in a second, but aside from agreeing with Barack Obama and his stance on withdrawal of troops from Iraq, you also defended him early on in the presidential campaign in his statement that we should engage Iran in dialogue, and you were critical of John McCain's criticism of that position. You said engagement is not and should not be confused for capitulation. Why is that your point of view and not a point of view that is shared by very many that I know about, at least, in the Republican Party?
Well, I'm a bit surprised by that, not because my point of view is not supported or shared by many in the Republican Party. That's irrelevant. I'm irrelevant to this issue. Diplomacy is engagement. You don't build your diplomatic efforts around talking to your friends. Yes, you build alliances around relationships that are defined by common interests. But diplomacy is about engaging potential adversaries. In Iran's case, can we really point to successes we've had regarding trying to influence the behavior of Iran, whether that's with Hezbollah in Lebanon and the Palestinian territories, a direct threat to Israel, whether it's on the eastern border of Iraq, where Iran is, whether it's on the western border of Afghanistan, where Iran is? No, things have gotten worse. And putting aside what capability the Iranians might have or are developing in the way of nuclear weaponry. So the point is, it seems to me that it's logical that you engage people. You find some common denominator of self-interest to deal with other nations, because the point of diplomacy is to try to influence an outcome, is to get to an end objective. If you don't do that through engagement and diplomacy, and it's just but one tool, by the way, it's not all of the tools we have, but if you don't use that tool, you will diplomatically walk yourself right into a cul-de-sac, and there's only one possible outcome. and that's conflict. Now, we're in two wars now. Those two wars are taking a very heavy toll on this country. Both two wars represent two of the longest wars we've ever been in. 7 years in Afghanistan. Things are worse today in Afghanistan than they've been at any time since we've been there. We have more troops there. Our casualty rates are higher this year than ever before. We have more money in there, more investment in there, more NATO troops in there. In Iraq, we still have more American troops in Iraq than we did before the so-called surge, and we're still spending $12 billion a month there. So diplomacy is critical to head off a crisis, to head off a conflict, to head off a war. And that seems to me is just fundamental for a great power. Great powers engage. Great powers don't run away.
We did that for years with the Soviet Union,
yes,
and others. What has led us down this path to believe that diplomacy is a sign of weakness, or it is a one step shy of appeasement?
Well, there's some thinking that has sprung up in mainly the Republican Party over the years that somehow a great powerful nation can essentially dictate its interests and the interests of others. Now, there's no question we, the United States, represent the most significant, strongest power on earth. No one is even in our universe, whether it's economic power, military power. You take your own metric and measure it. But the fact is, every challenge we face in the world today, start with proliferation of weapons of mass destruction, terrorism, extremism, environment, energy, despair, is connected to our alliances, is connected to stability and security in the world. And we need friends. We need alliances. We need relationships. We need to engage. We need a multilateral stretch here that would include the framing of our strategic interests with a framing of strategic policy, and that would include in the Middle East Iran, because Iran's tentacles are wrapped around everything there. They're wrapped around our interests there. They're wrapped around the future of Israel there. They're wrapped around everything. Iran's not the only country, but let's look at one thing that has actually produced some results, North Korea. So the first 5 years, this administration said, we're not going to deal with North Korea. Everything the Clinton administration did was wrong because the North Koreans lie and cheat and steal. Well, yes, they do. That's exactly right. Imperfect world. So we're going to make a better world by not engaging. So all that time allowed the North Koreans to rebuild, restock, restructure. Now, what is actually working is the effort that we've made to put together the six-party talks with our friends, our allies, the powers, the regional powers there who were affected by North Korea. It's imperfect. We're a long way from resolving everything, but at least we're not at war. At least we're getting in closer and closer every day. We're getting deeper into the North Korean psyche, into their bunkers, into their thinking, into their strategies, into their policy. Now, it seems to me that's just logical that we would engage.
Have we decided to go down that path because we are so tied up in Iraq and Afghanistan and our military is so stressed that we really can't afford a third front?
Well, that's what's forced, Michael, that's what's forced this new multilateralism in the Bush administration, because we now have no options. We have no choice. We don't have any Army left. We don't have any Marine Corps left. We're so heavily in debt now. We're going to run a $1 trillion deficit next year. We've run up more than a third of the nation's debt in the last 8 years.
Wow. When you look at all the problems that we face and you compound them with the recent economic difficulties that span the world, it gives one pretty dismal view of what's ahead of the next president and what's ahead of the nation. And just before we started this program, and maybe it's because you've written this book, America, Our Next Chapter, you told me that although we face some very difficult challenges, you are very optimistic that we're in a good position to come out of this okay. Why do you feel so optimistic?
Well, I do feel optimistic, not because our challenges are any less complicated or any less brutal, because I think what the next president faces is an inventory of problems as large or maybe larger than what FDR faced when he took office in 1933. In my opinion, they're bigger because they're deeper and wider and they're all global. But put that aside and focus on your question. I feel optimistic because our capacity to deal with these problems has never been greater. We have the largest economy in the world. It's the most flexible economy in the world. We are a nation of laws, of a constitution. The fiber and structure of our society, based on the fiber of our people, is good and strong. Our people believe in things greater than their own self-interest. When you add all this up in a balance sheet, and that's what you have to do, you can't be swayed and taken off course by singular events or issues or dynamics. You have to take a wider lens view of life, and especially when you're in charge of a country, President of the United States. And that means, like a corporate CEO or anybody heading up an institution, the bottom line is really critical here. And that means pay attention to your balance sheet. Mm-hmm. And our strengths far outweigh our liabilities, and our capacity to deal with those liabilities is, I think, better. We're better positioned than any time ever. And also, last point I'd make is leadership. No institution, no country, no society can long survive without the right kind of leadership. And I think within this bundle of trouble that the next president is going to deal with is an immense opportunity, an immense environment for opportunity to really make some changes that the American people, I believe, will be willing to support if they believe their next president is competent, is honest, and is reaching out to find a consensus.
Later in our 2008 conversation with Senator Chuck Hagel, just days before the election, we talked about campaign tactics, sometimes nasty ones.
Unfortunately, what campaigns are supposed to be about have been inverted, and now campaigns are not particularly conducive to intelligent conversation about policies and what a candidate would do if elected for the future of our country to deal with these problems. Unfortunately, it has been dragged down, campaigns and the whole political environment, into the lowest common denominator of raw political red meat. And that common denominator is almost hatred and intolerance. It's not good enough to defeat your opponent. You have to destroy him.
Doesn't the candidate and the campaign management have a choice? Do they have to go in that direction? Even if their opponent is calling them everything under the sun, do they have to go in that direction to combat it and to win?
No, I don't believe they do. I ran for office for the first time ever in 1996, ran for the Senate in Nebraska. But I said something to my family, my friends, my associates at the beginning of my campaign in 1996, and I said I was going to run a campaign that you could be proud of, mm-hmm. that the state of Nebraska could be proud of. But I think if every candidate started their campaign with that sentence, and you then must fulfill the pledge that you have just made to the people of your state. Now, there are differences, and those differences should be articulated, and I don't have any problem pointing out a record of an opponent,
right,
and other things that go with that. But when you go beyond that, and everyone knows when you go beyond that, then that's the beginning of defining down our system. And one other thing I'd put into this play: if we held candidates more accountable for their campaigns, I think some of this would stop. Too many candidates get away with this by saying, "Well, it was my consultant."
How would we do that? How would we hold a candidate?
Well, for example, the FEC, Federal Election Commission, controls expenditures and essentially is the regulator of federal campaigns. And you can violate all day long and all night long for months and months all the rules. And at the end, what they'll do to you, the Federal Election Commission, is after they settle it about a year later, after you're in office, they'll fine your campaign. The candidate has no personal liability. Mm-hmm. I would attach some personal liability to it. I think that you have a responsibility. If you're using the airwaves of your state and your country, and you're engaging in an important forum to talk about leadership of a country, and you are going to be one of the leaders, hopefully, you hope, then you have some obligations beyond just getting elected. I think there's where we have disconnected.
More of our 2008 conversation with Secretary of Defense nominee Chuck Hagel in a moment. Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Birdhouse on the Greenway, a bird lover's boutique providing a holistic approach to creating bird and wildlife habitats. Located in the shops at Piper Glen, bringing people and nature together. Birdhouseonthegreenway.com. Well, Martha Graham was a legendary choreographer who changed the face of contemporary dance. And her company, one of the most revered dance companies in the world, is coming to Charlotte for the first time in 30 years. She, of course, was known for groundbreaking 20th century choreography. But when they come to Charlotte, they will be performing with the UNC Dance Company some works that have never been performed here, including a lost work that has been reconstructed by a former member of the company who now is a choreography instructor at UNC Charlotte. That work, along with Aaron Copland's classic Appalachian Spring, which is Martha Graham's most famous work, will be on the bill, and we'll talk about all of this Monday at 9.
On the next Diane Reem Show, the Friday News Roundup, President Obama announces choices for key second-term positions. Vice President Biden meets with gun control advocates and the NRA, and new mortgage rules target risky lending.
Join the Diane Reem Show this morning from 10 to noon after Charlotte Talks on 90.7 WFAE, Charlotte's NPR news source.
It's Charlotte Talks on Listener Funded, 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. In nominating former Nebraska Republican Senator Chuck Hagel to be the next Secretary of Defense, President Obama said that our troops see him as one of their own.
Chuck knows that war is not an abstraction. He understands that sending young Americans to fight and bleed in the dirt and mud, that's something we only do when it's absolutely necessary. My frame of reference, he has said, is geared towards the guy at the bottom who's doing the fighting and the dying.
Yet despite his service in Vietnam and the bipartisan nature of his nomination, Senator Hagel faces hostility from within his own party. Part of that stems from his lack of support in 2008 for Senator John McCain over then-candidate Obama. And in our conversation just days before that election, we talked about that.
Well, as I noted earlier, both McCain and Obama are good friends. I'm probably the only Republican out there that's not endorsed McCain. I do not agree with John.
No, you're not the only Republican who hasn't endorsed McCain.
Well, I'm the only one in the Congress.
Okay.
The only one in the Congress. No, I'm sure I'm not the only Republican, but I'm the only, as far as I know, elected official in the Congress of the United States that has not endorsed a Republican.
And is that because you're not running for re-election? You don't have to do it because you don't have to be beholden?
No, I wouldn't if what I was running for election or re-election.
You still wouldn't.
I wouldn't. And the reason is because fundamentally I just don't agree with the approach that John would take in foreign policy. I think it's risky. I think it's dangerous. I just think it's the wrong approach. I don't agree with Obama on many things.
Okay.
I do agree with Obama on many of the national security issues, on foreign policy, on engagement. You mentioned one of the differences I have with McCain and my own party is on Iran.
Mm-hmm.
I've been talking about engaging Iran before Obama was elected to the Senate. I've been giving speeches on this for 10 years.
Are you confident that both these gentlemen, whoever is elected, if they are tested, as has come up in this campaign, that they will be able to respond accordingly to that test, despite whatever level of experience they may have in government or whatever level of experience they may have in the military? Because you come from the military. Mm-hmm. You have two Purple Hearts. You were also the deputy director of the Veterans Administration for a period of time. Do you have confidence in both of these men in those areas?
I do, but it would depend, and whoever is president will be tested. Make no mistake about it. Joe Biden may have said it awkwardly and said it at the wrong time, which the McCain people seized upon, mm-hmm. on what he said and how he said it and when he said it. But sure, the next president is going to be tested, and probably significantly over the next 4 years. It's going to greatly depend on who the next president brings around him that he will rely on for their judgment and their advice. His National Security Council, who's that? Who he appoints the next president as his national security advisor, his Secretary of State, Secretary of Defense. I would include in that Secretary of Treasury. I told President Clinton back in the late 90s that I would include my Secretary of Treasury in all matters regarding national security.
Hmm.
Why? Because obviously what's going on in the world today affects our security, a global financial crisis, instability, insecurity. So it's going to depend on the judgment of whoever wins based on who he then surrounds himself with, who he relies on to give him the wisest counsel. And then in the end, the two requisite requirements, mm-hmm. indispensable requirements for leadership, especially president: character and judgment. You can get along without the others.
They both have that?
I think they both have character. On judgment, we'll have to wait and see.
And I ask you why, that you've said that you have not endorsed a political, you have not endorsed a presidential candidate, and you don't intend to. But I'm just curious as to how you feel about the fact that your wife did, your wife Lilibet, did in Alexandria earlier this month, Alexandria, Virginia, on October the 7th. Here's what she had to say.
The fictions and the fallacies of the last 8 years have diminished my sense of hope in our country's future. Whether it is rising energy costs, dropping home values, decreasing wages, or a shrinking middle class. Whether it is warrantless wiretaps of unsuspecting Americans, secret prisons around the world, the firing of good U.S. attorneys for no good reason, or buried somewhere deep in this mess, those elusive weapons of mass destruction. None is American and is most certainly not the America I know and love. Thankfully, we have a chance to right our course with a leader that is smart, dedicated, steady, and wise. This election and Barack Obama's campaign is not about looking back, nor is it about fighting phantom issues churned out by a top-notch slander machine. Most importantly, it is not about distracting the public, you and me, with whatever slur someone thinks will stick.
This is your wife talking. What? How does that? That's going to be uncomfortable for you as an elected official, isn't it?
Not at all. Very proud of her. She wrote that herself. She did not show it to me. And I actually was in Asia, China, Japan, South Korea, when that news conference was held. She was with Susan Eisenhower and a number of Republican women who had all come together that day to endorse Barack Obama. Mm-hmm. I think what she says is accurate, and I'm proud of the role she's taken there.
Then why haven't you endorsed?
Because I have, as I said, I have told both these candidates that I think politically it's better for them and for me if I stay out of it. I don't think anyone is, quite frankly, on the edge of their seats waiting for me to endorse someone. I don't think my endorsement is going to tip the election one way or the other. And the other part of it is, too, we all have a certain amount of capital in life. How we choose to expend that capital is the real critical nature of each individual's success in life. And if I am to help either one of these men in any way, and by the way, that doesn't imply any government job, and I've told them each I don't need a cabinet job, I don't need a title, I might be able to help them far more on the outside as a private citizen. And I've got to put that capital where I think it could mean the most for them to lead the country and be the most effective for our country, and that is helping them govern in some way.
Well, earlier this year you did say that Huffington Post reports that you said that Barack Obama has the best chance of bringing the country together, that you believe that Barack Obama, for generational reasons, could best bring the country mm-hmm. together. You did say that?
Yes.
You decided not to run for re-election, and you decided to do that two terms was enough when you were elected mm-hmm. to your first term. So you're following through on a decision or a promise that mm-hmm. you made. Would you turn down a cabinet appointment in a Barack Obama or a John McCain administration?
Well, I don't expect that will come.
Really? With your experience in the military, with your interest in foreign affairs, Secretary of State, Secretary of Defense would not be of interest to you or offered to you, perhaps?
I don't expect it to happen. I'm building my future based on being a private citizen when I escape on January 3rd. Obviously, if a president of the United States calls anyone and ask them to consider taking a major position in the government to help the country, to help them, I would certainly have to honor that and seriously consider it. But again, I don't expect that to happen, and if it does, then I'll deal with it.
Some have suggested you would be a great Secretary of Defense. And I know that some have also said that the current Secretary of Defense might be asked to stay on by one administration or another. And yet you do have this incredible interest and this expertise in foreign affairs. Where do you think you could best serve if you were asked to? If the president, if the new president said, "I'd like to offer you a position in the cabinet," which one would you like? Which would it be?
Well, that is not going to happen. But I don't ever entertain hypothetical questions for obvious reasons, because you can get yourself in a lot of trouble very quickly before you even realize it. But
no one's listening.
I know. trying to at least give you an adequate response to your question, I have told Obama and McCain that if I can help in some way, I will do it. We've not had any conversations beyond that. Again, I say I don't expect any call. If a call comes in on any particular area that the president-elect wants to discuss with me, certainly I'll have to. Any American would have to consider it. But beyond that, I just don't speculate.
Okay. Senator Chuck Hagel, Nebraska's senior senator, is with us. His new book is called America, Our Next Chapter. You have served on four very important committees in your time in the Senate, the Foreign Relations Committee, the Banking Committee, Housing and Urban Affairs, and Intelligence and Rules. As a member of the Banking Committee and as a former, I believe, president of an investment bank in Omaha, talk about your impressions of how we got into this financial mess that we are in. And there's no reason to point fingers of blame, I suppose, because there's so many fingers of blame to go around. But how did we do it? What happened here?
Well, I think the larger frame of reference here when we address that question would be answered this way. We over-leveraged, we over-borrowed, we over-mortgaged, we came loose completely of any fiscal responsibility, fiscal policy moorings. We disregarded budgets, we disregarded markets, we manipulated markets, and when you further define that down, it was the housing market in particular, as we wrapped and rewrapped subprime mortgage instruments, got into complicated derivatives. The hedge funds played this. There was no oversight over any of this in our federal regulatory agencies. There was no transparency. Mm-hmm. And when you add all that up, it just built on itself. And I mentioned earlier in the program, Mike, that we've run up more than a third of the nation's debt in the last 7 years. Well, just take that component of this. We developed an environment of anything goes, anytime, just let it rip, kind of an Old West type of thing. We were deceitful in the Congress on our budgeting. We essentially lied. You know, all of us in Congress, if we were playing by the same rules that corporate executives are, it would be another Enron. You know, we'd all be indicted. Some of us would be in jail over this. And as you say, it's an entire cast of characters that's responsible. But I would answer your question the way I did.
Well, you saw this mess coming years ago. You sponsored a bill calling for regulatory overhaul of Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac. Your committee said that back then, I think this was 2003 or 2005, I can't remember which, that if effective regulatory reform legislation is not enacted this year, whatever year that was, American taxpayers will continue to be exposed to the enormous risk that Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac pose to the housing market, the overall financial system, and the economy as a whole. Nobody listened?
Nobody listened. We finally passed my bill, or most of it, this year, and I kept introducing and reintroducing that bill. It started in 2001. I couldn't get one Republican and one Democrat to co-sponsor with me for one entire Congress.
Why?
Then they just didn't think it was worthy of their efforts. And Fannie and Freddie were masters at deceit, and the money that they were using, they were using tens of millions of dollars to lobby against my bill. There was a big Associated Press story that came out about a week ago on this. And by the way, to give Senator Dole a little credit on this, in 2003, she was one of the first, or actually 2005, I think, one of the first of two senators that actually co-sponsored my bill with me, she and Senator Sununu from New Hampshire. I never did get one Democrat, by the way. Not one Democrat would sponsor it. And the only reason we were able to get it done this year is because Fannie and Freddie, because essentially their criminal acts, which, as you know, there are criminal investigations going on right now on Fannie and Freddie and the individuals there, because they did it to themselves, and they forced the Congress to deal with this.
There was a news story last night, and it was in the paper again this morning, that some of the banks that we are bailing out, some of the investment houses, are planning to give their executives corporate bonuses this year. Now, whether or not they use the money that Congress provided to save their little fannies, is there something that Congress could do, should do, to stop them from paying themselves bonuses? And some of the people, and you used to be in this business, some of the people in that business say, if you don't let these companies that are in trouble and have been bailed out pay bonuses to these executives will simply leave these failing institutions and go someplace else or start their own investment businesses so that they can get this money. I mean, to the average person, these bonuses are more than they make in 10 years.
Well, in fact, we did write into the Stabilization Act that we passed a month ago, which put up $700 billion to buy into these financial institutions. As you know, nine banks have already been given authority to go ahead and start processing this money. But we built in through legislation and through specific articles in that legislation limitations on compensation for executives. Now, part of also what's going on here, too, is whether they these banks, financial institutions, should pay dividends, quarterly dividends. And there's a balance here as to what you have to strike, because if the objective is to unlock, unfreeze credit, thereby unlocking liquidity, thereby opening up the banking system so that people can start to consume again, spend again, borrow again, and so on. All that is tied into this, and it all has to be factored together. But we did write specific legislation in there that this money was not to go to major corporate executives' bonuses.
Even if they don't use the money you gave them, if they use existing money within the company.
By the way, this is, just to make it clear for your listeners, this wasn't money the taxpayers giving them. This is a loan, and we bought into their system and so on. So I know maybe there's a fine line on that, but it's not a matter of we just giving them $700 billion.
Why should executives who have screwed things up this badly be getting anything? Why shouldn't they be getting the boot?
Well, many of them have, as you know. I think every one of the major financial institutions in New York, their top management's gone, as Fannie's is gone, as Freddie's is gone, and it should be that way. But let me explain something to your listeners just in a little general sense of what's important here. What's the objective? The objective is to try to salvage the system from collapsing totally, thereby saving insurance plans, pension plans, annuities, health care plans, small business, jobs. And we can't just stand back and do nothing here. And so it's a tough call. It's imperfect. It's a problem. And I think the wisest of all of us would have difficulties with this, trying to sort it out, because the very essence of what you said is exactly right. Why should anybody who screwed this up be rewarded in any way? And we're trying to weed that out as best we can. But in the meantime, we've got a huge economy, and the world economy is going down. We're putting tens of thousands of people out of work every day. Insurance annuity plans, pension plans, savings plans, no credit. It'll collapse this country in a very dangerous way if we don't do something.
So what you're saying is that along with the big pill, the big bitter pill that we've had to swallow, there may be some smaller bitter pills that we have to swallow to keep the thing running.
Well, it's imperfect, and I think most people understand it. There's a lot of it I don't like. There's a lot of it Secretary Paulson said he didn't like. But again, we've got to be wise enough to stand back and look at the larger objective here.
Secretary of Defense nominee Chuck Hagel. More in a moment. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Spark Publications, helping local professionals to creatively custom publish their own books. Hosting a January 18th seminar on custom publishing. More info at the seminar tab at sparkpublications.com. Coming up on the Diane Rehm Show, it's the weekly news roundup, the national hour first at 10, the international hour at 11. They'll be talking about the week's top stories, undoubtedly about the president's cabinet appointments. including Senator Chuck Hagel, gun control, and Vice President Biden's panel on gun safety, among the other topics in the 10 o'clock hour. And when we come back, we will be joined by Dr. Michael Bitzer, the professor of political science at the Catawba College, to talk more about Chuck Hagel's appointment to the Secretary of Defense and what's going on Capitol Hill and why there's such friction about this appointment when we come back.
If you're going to teach etiquette to high school students, it's important to remember that Rome just wasn't built in a day, you know.
We still did have a student that just stuck a whole chicken with a fork and ate it off the fork. But, you know, baby steps.
I'm Kai Rizdahl, preparing kids for life after the classroom, next time on Marketplace from 8 p.m.
Marketplace this evening at 6:30 on 90.7 WFAE.
It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We spent the first part of this program revisiting our 2008 conversation with then-Nebraska Senator Chuck Hagel, the Republican nominated this week by President Obama to be the next Secretary of Defense. Of the several nominees for various cabinet positions announced this week by the president for his second term, it is Hagel who seems to face a tough road ahead, and whatever opposition materializes will come from the Republican side of the aisle. Here to talk about the reasons for that opposition and what may unfold in the days ahead is political scientist Dr. Michael Bitzer, chair of the Department of History and Political Science at Catawba College in Salisbury and frequent contributor to WFAE's political blog, The Party Line. Welcome back.
Good to be here.
Well, it became clear several weeks ago that Republicans would stonewall President Obama's choice for Secretary of State. Now they're going after Chuck Hagel and possibly his nominee for CIA director because they're upset about all the secrecy surrounding Benghazi. So how normal or abnormal is this to witness this kind of opposition to a reelected second-term president and his choices for cabinet?
I think this is norm. I mean, I would be shocked if Hagel and Brennan for CIA don't get confirmed. But I think, you know, the opposition always has to feel like they are being the loyal opposition and that they are raising concerns, they are raising questions. Remember, they went after his UN ambassador pretty harshly, and she basically withdrew her name from consideration for Secretary of State. So, you know, he went with John Kerry. President Obama has gone with John Kerry. That's a very safe, there'd be, you know, should be a unanimous vote there. So I think the Republicans feel like, hey, we need to raise some kind of dust about national security, and this is one way to do it.
But now John Kerry is a Democrat. A Senate Democrat. This Chuck Hagel fella, as we well know, is a Republican senator, a former Republican senator. How unusual is it for a member of the opposition party to be opposed by the opposition party?
Well, that you're starting to raise some hairs on the back of people's necks. You know, this kind of issue, and we have to differentiate, you know, within a political party, there is no one ideal type of person. And Chuck Hagel was very much someone like John McCain who was seen as kind of a maverick. Yes, he was a conservative. Yes, he believed in conservative beliefs. But on issues such as national security, on defense issues, he really went after the Bush administration. And I think some of his colleagues have very long-term memory, and they remember some of the comments, some of the issues, some of the concerns that he raised. And I think it's coming back to haunt him. It's unusual to have a member of the opposition party so prominent in a cabinet position. But remember, Barack Obama kept Bill Gates on as Bush's defense secretary for several months when he came into office. So I think this speaks more to the style of the president than necessarily the individual coming into the particular cabinet position.
And they've also said that President Obama seems to be influenced by President Lincoln and by Doris Kearns Goodwin and her book, Book of Rivals. It was it's not Book of Rivals. It's
Team of Rivals.
Team of Rivals.
Yes.
In which President Lincoln put many of his enemies close at hand in the cabinet.
Exactly. But I think this goes back even further. I mean, if you understand and look at what Barack Obama did, particularly when he was president of the Harvard Law Review, he named some substantial number of conservative law students to the Harvard Law Review and really raised eyebrows among people who were progressives and liberals. Why are you doing that? And I think Obama likes the challenge, likes the debate, likes to hear the other side before making decisions. I think this kind of fits the mold of who he is as a kind of commander-in-chief leader in that regard.
That said, though, he and Chuck Hagel evidently have a lot in common. He talked about in the nomination speech that he made nominating Mr. Hagel, he talked about their trips to the Middle East and having exchanged ideas, and they evidently agree on a lot of things.
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
Where do Senate Democrats fall on Hagel's nomination?
You haven't heard very much. You haven't heard the effusive support, but I think that they will be behind their president. I mean, senators generally tend to be very differential when it comes to presidential appointments. Yes, they want to be consulted. They want the senatorial courtesy of having some acknowledgement of their presence in this process. But I think they're going to basically give him what he wants because this is the president's cabinet, and these are the people that he feels most comfortable in nominating and trusting for their advice.
But they didn't give him what he wanted in terms of Secretary of State.
Well,
Didn't come to a vote, but it was clear that they were going to put up a fight.
Right. And Ambassador Rice, I think, you know, she tried to convince particularly Republicans, particularly moderate Republicans like Susan Collins, regarding the Benghazi affair, and she just backfired. I mean, it did not work. And when you can't get somebody as moderate as Susan Collins to give you any sorts of support and instead come out and say, I am still even more troubled by this, I think that potential nomination was doomed from the get-go.
As we've said, I think you've said this too, Chuck Hagel was blunt-spoken during his time in the Senate. He opposed Republican positions many times. He opposed President Bush on many things. He declined to support John McCain in his presidential bid in 2008. His wife supported the president, President Obama, in 2008. Is that the primary source of friction here, or is there more to it than that?
I think there's certainly that. I mean, if you listen to his comments, he said he was not going to support either McCain or Obama. They all knew each other. McCain and Hagel were very much, you know, kind of close allies representing the kind of renegade Republicans in the Senate. But when McCain had to basically tack to the right to get the presidential nomination, I think that probably turned off Hagel in some regards, particularly with the neocon conservative belief in national security and defense and the issues in Iraq. And so there was obviously a split there. And I think Hagel just decided, you know, I know both of these men. I've traveled with Obama. I think it's best just for me to stay neutral. And I think that's where he earned the trust of the president.
Pundits and politicians have been hashing over his calling the Israeli lobby the Jewish lobby, and what, if anything, that means. What does it mean? Do you have a theory on that?
You know, I think the situation with Israel is always probably one of the most delicate when it comes to Congress and to the administration. And I think Hagel is going to have to offer some kind of explanation, particularly when he meets one-on-one with the senators, if not in the Senate hearings before the Armed Services Committee. You know, it's a concern that he raised. We also have to recognize that in the state of Israel, they have a conservative government under administration right now. So there's a lot of behind-the-scenes maneuvering and issues going on there. So the influence of the Israeli lobby certainly is profound on Capitol Hill, but I would be surprised if that was the thing that truly dooms this nomination.
Well, Chuck Hagel says that despite that reference to the Jewish lobby, he is a big supporter of Israel. Mm-hmm. Yet Iran has said that it is hopeful about his nomination to lead the Defense Department because they believe it could lead to better relations. And in the interview we just played with Senator Hagel from 2008, he pointed out that diplomacy is about engaging potential adversaries, and he asked if we could point to any successes in our attempts to influence Iran gained by not talking to them. He said the answer to that was no.
Yeah.
So is a statement like that, coupled with Iran's semi-endorsement.
That may be the thing that could be the kiss of death.
Is that the kiss of death? That was my question.
Well, I think, you know, this also fits into what we heard from then-candidate Obama in 2008. He said on the campaign trail that he would be willing to talk to anyone. And I think he shares Hagel's belief in engagement. I mean, you have the differing ideas within diplomatic relations and international relations that you should use hard power, military strength, or you can use soft power, things like negotiations, engagement, discussions. And I think, you know, this is going to be the real struggle on the international stage. John Kerry is very much an engagement type of person, I think, and Hagel would be that too. So I think it fits nicely in an alignment for the president's position. And certainly Iran is hurting right now. I mean, I'm no expert on that, but my understanding is their economy is suffering due to the sanctions. They want to have the discussion. The question is, how far can that discussion go?
But just as that may play into the president's style or his desire in the way he'd like to conduct foreign policy, it also plays into Republican fears because they feel the president's approach to foreign policy has been soft, and they want a harder edged approach. And so here we have Chuck Hagel coming in, agreeing with the president in that approach as the potential Secretary of Defense. You take that, you put those criticisms about President Bush in there, about the war in Iraq, mm-hmm. some of the letters that he wrote to the president, the then President Bush during his administration, about how he thinks he should have conducted international relations, plus his experience as a soldier in Vietnam, yeah. which, as the president said, has made him believe that it's more wise to be cautious about our use of the military.
Mm-hmm.
Is that too much like the president for Republicans to get behind?
I think it will be. I think we will see probably a majority of the Senate Republicans vote against this nomination. You've heard very clear indications from people like South Carolina's Lindsey Graham that this nomination is he's going to try and raise every kind of question I think he can against Hagel in this, and I would not be surprised if he doesn't vote against him on all of those issues. But you know, we will still see probably a confirmation, but it will not be unanimous, needless to say.
And then there's the gay issue. The log cabin Republicans, that's a group of gay Republicans, took out full page ads in I think the New York Times and the Washington Post this mm-hmm. week opposing Hagel, mentioning his previous comments about gay rights, which he made when he was a senator. Mm-hmm. And I think he was commenting about a potential nominee for ambassador
exactly.
who was openly gay and said he had no business serving.
Yeah.
And then went on to talk about some of the log cabin Republicans went on to talk about some of the concerns that we're addressing here about his other stances.
Yeah.
Has he reversed his position on gay rights?
He did come out, and he my sense was he profusely apologized for the comments made about it. I don't know. You know, remember, this is back in the 1990s under the Clinton administration. It was an ambassador to Luxembourg. He had the ambassador nominee had apparently participated in a gay rights parade, and Hagel came very much out against it and picked that as the issue that he was going to champion against it. You know, the evolution of belief about gay rights has been so dramatic in this country over the past 20 years. And I think perhaps now Hagel is looking back on it and saying, you know, I was wrong then. I apologize. And that could be, you know, a sense of where things have emerged with that particular issue.
Of course, he's being nominated to be Secretary of Defense, and the one part of this we haven't talked about is the military and their reaction. Some say that there are tensions between the president and the military. Mm-hmm. Would Chuck Hagel's presence as the civilian leader at the Pentagon act to relieve those tensions when you'd have a man as Secretary of Defense who shares some of Obama's views, but who also has military experience? Would he be a kind of bridge between two worlds?
I think Chuck Hagel would be the ideal kind of bridge. I mean, somebody who has multiple Purple Hearts, who was injured in Vietnam, who would be, I believe, the first enlisted soldier to assume the position of Secretary of Defense. He would be able to calm the fears between the military brass and the president, and I think would be a real clear linkage between the two, and also be able to be someone who can come in and say, you know what, the bloating in the Pentagon has got to be, something has got to be addressed about it. And I think he would have the prime podium to kind of address that issue that everybody seems to recognize needs to be addressed.
And at the very beginning of the program, we played one of the president's comments when he introduced Chuck Hagel as his nominee, and he said that he would be a person who was in the trenches and have the interests of the fighting men in his sights at all time. That would give him the impression to our rank and file soldiers that they had somebody in the highest office in the Pentagon looking out for them. You think that's true?
Oh, exactly. I mean, somebody who knows the experience, who has been in those kinds of battle situations, and knows what soldiers potentially are having to go through. There's no substitute for that kind of experience.
So what should or what can Chuck Hagel do if he wants to encourage more Republican votes and win this nomination?
I think he has to be very clear in his confirmation and his one-on-ones with senators, particularly with those folks on the Armed Services Committee. I think, you know, people like John Cornyn, who have already come out and said, I will not support this. you know, those are lost votes already. So he's going to have to kind of work towards the middle. But I would be shocked if anybody tried to filibuster.
We only have a minute left. I'm curious as to, can the Republicans afford to be successful in their opposition? Congress's approval rating is far lower than the president's. He's been reelected. He's put the Republican Congress in the light of being obstructionist. And wouldn't this attempt at a bipartisan relationship solidify that criticism?
I think it would. The potential backfire would be pretty devastating, I think, on the Republican side.
And what would happen if they were successful? What would happen to the president? Because there would be two major nominees who have been rejected, essentially.
You know, if they wanted somebody who was even more to the left in the Secretary of Defense's position, that's what they would probably get.
Dr. Michael Bitzer, chair of the Department of History and Political Science at Catawba College and frequent contributor to WFAE's political blog, The Party Line. Thank you very much. Appreciate it.
My pleasure.